All right. Welcome. Thank you for being here. My name is Jordan Koss. I am the Youth and Family Integration Minister at Davis Park Church of Christ in Modesto, California. I don't know if you know where Modesto is, but if you go halfway between San Francisco and Yosemite National Park, that's Modesto, you know, out in the breadbasket, Central Valley of California. And we've been out there for about, my wife and I, Corey, have been out there for about 3 years. And one of the first things that I was able to do once we moved out here to California is that my father-in-law, who lives in the Bay Area, got tickets to go to a Sticky Faith fundraiser at none other than Ronnie Lott's house, the famous 49er middle linebacker, you know, and Kara Powell was going to speak there. And so me and him, we drive up to Ronnie Lott's house, which is up on a ridge on the top of the Santa Cruz Mountains overlooking the Silicon Valley, and it's awesome. And we go and we walk in and I see Ronnie Lott and I'm like, I'm too nervous to introduce myself to him. So I go over to the coffee table and I pour myself some coffee and then I pour some cream in my coffee and I grab one of those long wooden fancy coffee stirrers and I stir the cream in my coffee. And without even looking, I just put the coffee stirrer into what I think is the used coffee stirrer container. And it was not the used coffee stirrer container. It was the new coffee stirrer container. And so I realized right when I did it, I realized that. So I'm looking at this container. I'm thinking, trying to find my coffee stirrer, and I can't figure out which one it is because they all look the same. And as I'm freaking out, I notice somebody's looking at me. I have that feeling. And so I look up, and it's none other than Ronnie Lott's wife giving me this weird look on, what are you doing, man? Because she saw everything I just did. And so great, all I could feel like, oh, man, Ronnie Lott's wife thinks I'm a weirdo. But that was my beginning, if you will, in the start of experiencing doing and trying to develop sticky faith within students in youth ministry. And that next year in 2013, our church participated in the Fuller Youth Institute's Sticky Faith cohort with churches from around the country. And part of my job in coming into that church was to instill sticky faith into the culture of that congregation. And so this lecture is kind of some gleanings from my time and experience trying to do that. And so what I want to do in terms of starting off, I want to tell a story, and it's the story of James, the brother of Jesus, and how he died. It's his martyrdom story, which comes down to us from through Eusebius, the church historian, and I think it's pretty cool. If you've never heard it before, here you go. And it's about like the early 60s AD, and it's the time of one of those big Jewish festivals, and everybody's coming into Jerusalem, and the Jews, the scribes, the Pharisees are tired of people putting their faith in Jesus. And so they ask James, because James has a great reputation in Jerusalem, so much so they call him James the Just. They're like, James, you know, you're a smart man. Everybody honors you and thinks you're a great person. Go up to the pinnacle of the temple. Go up to the pinnacle of the temple. And from there, shout to everybody down below the busiest intersection of the city, the southwest corner of the Temple Mount. That's what we refer to. It's not the top of the temple structure itself, but it's the southwest corner of the Temple Mount. And down below is where the busiest intersection of the city. They say, go up there and denounce Jesus so that no more people will believe that he's the Messiah anymore. And so James is like, okay, I'll go up there. And he goes up there, and what does he do? He does the exact opposite thing that they want him to do, and he proclaims that Jesus Christ is the Messiah, the Son of God. And so they're standing behind him, looking at each other like, what do we just allow him to do here? And so they look at each other and like, well, what do we do now? And their decision was, let's throw him over the edge. And so they throw him over the edge, down all the way down to that intersection, to the street below, a couple hundred feet, and he survives the fall. And then, so to try to finish him off, they start stoning him. And so finally, when the stoning doesn't really work, a guy grabs a Fuller's club, goes up to him like a baseball player with a bat, and just clubs him over the head and kills him. But before he died, before he was struck in the head with that Fuller's club, he said these words. He said, I entreat thee, Lord God, our Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. I think we've heard those words before. He spoke, and he acted, and he died just like his half-brother Jesus did 30 years before. And he also stood up to the test, to that trial, to that temptation, the very spot where Satan took Jesus 30 or so years prior in the temptation in Matthew chapter 4. So in the end, what we have here, after Jesus, the resurrected Jesus, appeared to his brother James, that Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, after James put his faith in his resurrected brother, the Messiah, He, some 30 years later, had developed an authentic Christ-like faith that went as far as you could possibly go in terms of giving up your life on behalf of the faith, on behalf of God, on behalf of Jesus. And so when we come to James chapter 1, we're going to look at a passage this afternoon, James chapter 1. When we come to James chapter 1, 2 through 18, we see James is shooting to help his Jewish Christian brothers and sisters develop and help nurture an authentic faith and character in their life. And so what we find in these verses is an expanded narrative, a series of sayings on temptations and how to respond and how not to respond. And they don't focus on belief. He assumes their belief is orthodox. But what he focuses on is how to live. And wisdom is the thing that helps you live right and make right choices and how to respond to trials and temptations. And so, and as we've heard throughout all these lectures on James this week, is that James pulls and gathers from the wisdom tradition and how he writes. So when we read James in James chapter 1, we're reading something that's more like Proverbs than Paul in a letter. And so one of those aspects that James pulls in and he borrows from wisdom literature is the idea of the two ways, the right way, the wrong way, the wise way and the way of the fool that we read about in Proverbs. And so in verse 12, what we find here is the how to respond to trials and temptations that we could just say, this is how James responded there in that story of his martyrdom. It says, "Blessed is a man who endures under trial. For once he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life, which the Lord has promised to those who love him." All right? And the how not to respond to trials and temptations is found in verses 13 through 18, right after this verse. And so you may be thinking, one way that you probably shouldn't respond to trials and temptations, the how not to respond to trials and temptations, is to doubt God. Because the number one question in the latest volume of the Can I Ask That curriculum from Sticky Faith, the first question that they tackle in that curriculum is it wrong to doubt God? Well, after reading James 1, 5 through 8, you kind of come away, walking away, thinking that, yeah, doubting God is not the how-to, is not the right way, is not the wise way to respond to trials and temptations. It's definitely not the way to nurture an authentic faith that goes further. And yet, ironically, what we find in research by Barna Group, David Kinnaman, and Sticky Faith is this. David Kinnaman says in his book, You Lost Me, where it talks about the top six things that 18 to 29-year-olds say they perceive the church to be, which is why after growing up in church they said, "You lost me." One of those six things was that they perceived the church to be doubtless. And in the midst of that chapter on that perception, David Kinnaman says, "I believe unexpressed doubt is one of the most powerful destroyers of faith." And in the Sticky Faith research, Kara Powell says this in her book. She says, "Most kids doubt their faith in high school, but few talk about those doubts. Yet the students who feel most free to express doubts and discuss personal problems with youth leaders and their youth groups show more sticky faith." Okay, so I want you to keep that in mind as we look at a picture of how James responds to the doubts and questions that have arisen from the reality of evil in our lives through experiencing trials and temptations. And as we'll see, the space that James uses to do so is space itself, as he tackles the how not to way of responding to trials and temptations. So let's check this out. He starts out in verse 13, and here's what he says. He says, "Let no one say when he is tempted, 'I am being tempted by God.' For God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one." And this is a common response even still today in our own lives, especially in my own, is what's the question we ask when we experience a hardship, a trial, a temptation? It's like, why is this happening to me? Why? Is God, and we go further and then we say, why is God tempting me? And therefore, if God is tempting me, is God therefore the ultimate cause and origin of evil and sin in my life and in the world? Well, James doesn't have a problem with those questions that have arisen in their lives and his readers' lives as a result of them experiencing these trials. He's got no problem with those questions. But what he's got a problem with is the answer that they come to. And that's yes. yes, God is tempting me. Yes, therefore, God is the ultimate cause of sin and evil in my life and in the world. And James has an initial response in this verse. And that he just cuts right to. He says, hey, God cannot be tempted, and God does not tempt anyone. Let's just lay that on the line first off before we go any farther. God cannot be tempted, and God does not tempt anyone. And in the next two verses, he breaks out into a theodicy, a defense of God, where he talks about the true source of all evil. And so here's what he says in verse 14. He says, but each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. So James doesn't shift the blame to God, doesn't even bring Satan into the discussion. It doesn't even say, doesn't even blame it on the stars, but on human desire. Human desire leads to temptation, and that ultimately leads us to sin when we, in essence, take the bait. He uses these metaphors and borrows these metaphors from fishing and hunting and trapping. So, in essence, our desire is what lures us to that hook with the bait on it, and we take it, and that's when we sin. And in the movie Interstellar, which came out in November of this past year, 2014. It ran from November all the way to the end of March of this year. It was nominated for 5 Oscars. One of them, it won, Best Visual Effects. It was one of the most popular movies of this past year. And in that movie, there's a scene where Anne Hathaway, one of the female lead of the movie, is talking about what they're going to experience as astronauts going out on a mission to save humanity, to find a new planet that they can live on because Earth is dying. And she tells this other astronaut, you know, we're going to experience all kinds of obstacles, all kinds of who knows what, and face almost certain death in this mission. But the one thing we're not going to encounter is evil. There's no evil out there, she says. It's just what we take with us. And later on in the movie, there's a surprise cameo by the actor Matt Damon, who plays the character Dr. Man, and he's referred to as the remarkable Dr. Man several times in the movie, and he's the one who leads the Lazarus missions to save humanity. And what we have, though, he's referenced as he represents the best of us, the best of humanity. But in the end of the movie, what does he do? He ends up representing the worst of us because he almost ruins the mission by his selfishness. And so what you have is basically what James is saying is that we are all Dr. Man. Wherever we go, we take it with us. Paul then moves further in this thought, and he says, when it has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. So, if you will, when we give in to desire, James, is borrowing in these same thoughts from wisdom literature, and how wisdom literature personifies wisdom as Lady Wisdom, and also personifies folly and foolish living as Madame Folly. And here he personifies desire as a woman that when you take the bait, it's like you go to bed with her. And when you go to bed with desire, she gives birth to 2 babies. The first baby is sin. And the second baby is death. And so what you end up having is a Dr. Man family where my wife or your wife is desire and your kids are sin and death. And in James' mind, evil in human experience is that for which human beings are directly responsible. And this correlates very much so with the thought that's expressed by Julius Caesar in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, when Julius Caesar says this to the Brutus, the fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves, for we are underlings. You know, I asked my father-in-law not too long ago, who was an English major in college, about, you know, what is the idea behind that statement? And he says, well, basically the idea is, you know, is it fate that ultimately led to Julius Caesar's death, a fate that was written in the stars, or was it his own ambitious decisions that led to his death and his assassination? And so in essence, I think that what Julius Caesar says, it was his own decisions. And I think that's exactly what James is saying here as well in these first few verses, is that our fate is due to our faults. That evil and sin are a reality in our lives because we allow our desire to determine our decisions. All right? So he then moves on to the second half of his argument, and he says this to start it off. He says, wrong direction. Do not be deceived, my beloved brothers. And so he changes gears here, and he puts in this pointed introduction that introduces a significant statement that he's about to say. And so, and the significant statement that follows will be another theodicy. It's an argument about the true source of all good. All right? Instead of the true source of all evil being human. So here's where it goes with this. And this verse is often, you often see this posted on people's walls in their homes, but I think after today, hopefully this brings new meaning to this verse. He says, every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. So here's the significant statement right here. Everything good, nothing evil, is from God. Now, recently, my parents came to visit us out in California, out in Modesto, and my dad hadn't been there since like the early 90s on a business trip, and he just visited San Francisco for like 2 days. And my mom hadn't been out there since 1969 on a road trip with her two sisters after she graduated high school. And so they were like really excited. And so we picked them up from the airport in Sacramento, and we were driving them down 99. And one of the towns that you pass through from Sacramento on 99 to get to Modesto is Lodi, California. And when my dad saw that sign on the road, he's like, huh, hey, stuck in Lodi again. I'm like, wait a second, that's a song, right? It's the song by Creedence Clearwater Revival, Stuck in Lodi Again, even though you can't really understand what those lyrics are when you actually listen to the song. And so after they left, Corden's birthday came around in November, and I was trying to decide what I was going to do for her birthday, because we just don't give like little, buy gifts of here, happy birthday. We want to do something more and have an experience together to remember. And so I was thinking, you know what? I'll take her to Lodi. Lodi, they're trying to revive downtown Lodi, and I think she'll think it's cool. And so before she gets home one day, I'll put Stuck in Lodi on Spotify, have that playing as she's walking in. And she was walking in again. I'm like, hey, happy birthday. Want to go get stuck in Lodi? No. She's like, let's go to Spaghetti Factory in Stockton instead. I'm like, man, all right. Okay, I thought that was going to work, but it didn't. I am not the best gift giver in the world, and yet, so I'm glad that God is, and that's what James says. And he moves on, and he says in the second phrase, so every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights. That's a technical term. It's a technical term referring to God as the creator of the stars, the creator of the heavenly bodies, the sun, the moon, the stars, the planets, so on and so forth. And as the creator of those things, of the heavenly bodies, of the stars, James then makes a distinction. He's like, even though God created them, he's not like them. The Father of the lights has no variation or shadow due to change. And those two phrases have to refer to the different ways we were able to see how the sun changes and how it sets and it rises, how the different phases of the moon, how we can't always see the stars because they're blocked by the clouds. And so God's character, as opposed to his creation, the Father of lights, is consistent. It's always the same. It's always good, whatever point that he is seen from. But our character, our human character, our Dr. Man character, it's like the stars, or in essence, it's like, you could call it interstellar. And interstellar basically means occurring or situated between the stars. But James here is being controversial because the worldview in which he's writing into is this fatalistic worldview where the stars determine your fate. It's that same worldview evidenced in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, where the discussion is, was Julius Caesar's fate determined by the stars, or was it determined by his decisions? And so one response, though, that people have that we see James responding to is, yes, God did this to me, and so therefore God is tempting me, and my conclusion is God is a jerk, because evil is his will. And I don't want to follow a God like that who would cause this evil and this temptation in my life for me to experience this. How could that be the will of God? And another response could be passive endurance, where basically you would say, hey, why fight? It's determined in the stars. God has determined it. And so evil is his will. So it's all part of the plan, you know, as Joker says in Batman. But I think James would say both of these are off. And I think James would also say that Interstellar is off in some of its conclusions, because despite humans being evil in the movie, despite Anne Hathaway saying that, that there's nothing evil out there, we are evil and we take it with us wherever we go, humans in the end still save themselves. And what happens is, in the end, through those Lazarus missions, humans, through their science and technology, resurrect themselves and find a new planet to live on into the future. And so evil is ultimately never dealt with in the movie. And it's also ultimately never dealt with in that fatalistic worldview, in my opinion. But here's what James says in the final verse. In verse 18, this is what James says, God's will, or God's desire, births in response to evil and to sin to deal with it fully, as opposed to what man's desire births, which is sin and death. God's will, of his own will, he brought us forth by the word of truth, that we should be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. So in essence, James is saying here, just God's will, God's desire births us, brings about new life in us, and creates a new kind of family. Not the Dr. Man family, but the family of God saved through the blood of Jesus Christ. And that's, again, as opposed to man's desire birthing death and creating the Dr. Man kind of family. And so this word that James then uses to kind of complete his thought of his defense of God, saying God is the true source of all evil, this word, first fruits, is a jam-packed word with so much wrapped up in it. It's got that Pentecost background to it. You know, Paul says Jesus Christ and him, he is the first fruits of those who have been resurrected. And Paul says later in Romans chapter 8, where we have the first fruits of the Spirit, where he's talking about how when Christ returns, we're going to be resurrected, but not us only, but also God's entire creation. Because that's the only way evil will ultimately be dealt with, if God saves everything he has created. Because if Satan gets one thing, then Satan wins. And so James kind of gives us a prelude to the new creation. And the new creation, again, is that in which evil is dealt with fully, by just the use of that one word, first fruits. And I think that James's response to this question and these doubts that have arisen from trials and temptations in his readers' lives helps us to respond to Interstellar's answer to its main question. And its question in that movie is this. I think that the question is, will mankind find a new home? That's the basic question throughout the entire movie. Will mankind find a new home? Will they find salvation from a world destroyed by evil? In fact, the last two words of the movie in the script are new home, as Anne Hathaway is setting up base camp on that new planet that she found that's habitable. And the answer to that question in Interstellar is yes. Yes. Mankind will find a new home. And guess what? We did it ourselves. It's a climactic humanistic ending in a movie that doesn't even mention God. And part of that idea and that conclusion that I thought throughout the movie is something that another character said, is that he said, humans, we are not meant to save the world, but to leave it. And I think that that is the opposite of what God is doing through Jesus Christ in terms of the Christian faith. But I think that's escapist understanding of salvation is also quite rampant within Christian circles in how we understand God's big plan of what he's doing. And that, so our response, I think, needs to be to the question, will mankind find a new home? Will mankind find salvation for a world destroyed by evil? Our tweak of that answer in response to the answer that the movie gave to the question is yes, but a little bit differently. Mankind will find a new home, but that new home will be the very home that God created. And when Jesus Christ comes back, God's big picture is that Jesus Christ will make all things new and make everything right. He'll bring the world to rights, the writer N.T. Wright says in his book. So he writes about this, such as Surprised by Hope. So yes, and it is God who resurrects us and resurrects his creation, not humans resurrecting themselves. And there's another line in the movie that's a significant pointed saying where one of the characters says, we were born on earth, but we were never meant to die here. And so their intended meaning was, yeah, let's get out of here, let's escape, let's find a new planet. But in our Christian understanding of what God is doing through Jesus Christ in fully dealing with evil in the new creation is that, yes, we were born on earth, and we were never meant to die here, but we're going to stay here, and God's going to resurrect us, and his creation is going to fulfill its intended purpose for eternity as a result through Jesus Christ. And through that answer, God will deal with evil truly and ultimately. And so in essence, what you have James saying here is, I think you can sum up his main point into this statement. Your fate may be due to your faults, but your future is due to your Father. I think that's how you can wrap up in terms of what James is saying in response to those doubts and questions that have arisen from evil and sin in people's lives by encountering trials and temptations. And so the solution to people's doubts and people's questions is to not to squash them. It's not to squash their doubts, not to squash their questions, but to do what Interstellar does and to do what James does. And Megan Garber, in a review of the movie Interstellar, had to say this about one of the things that the movie does and that films do today. She says, filmmakers have developed a canny way to talk about religion in movies without actually, you know, talking about it, allowing themselves to explore the biggest of life's questions and ideas while avoiding uncomfortable conversations. And their method involves a political safe space, space itself, as James borrowed that very safe space as well to talk about the true source of all good as opposed to the true source of all evil. And in You Lost Me, David Kinman writes this: we need to create environments and experiences where students can process their doubts in secure and accepting relationships. And Kara Powell in Sticky Faith says, we need to be creating a youth ministry where students can talk about questions honestly, openly, and without fear. And that could be one of the best things we could do to help build a sticky faith, a faith that lasts beyond high school and beyond college and so forth. And so what I want to do now is I want to share with you an experience that we have done in terms of trying to create a safe space to express our doubts, to talk about questions, to talk about our doubts at our church in Modesto. And that one experiment has been what we've called off the wall. And how off the wall was bred was, it was bred out of our seniors getting together once a month, our Project 2016-2015 group. And they wanted to do this. They said that we wanted to get the congregation to submit questions that we could answer and start having conversations about things that we should be having conversations about in church, but most of the time we don't. And so what we did was, once every month, starting in November, we had an intergenerational panel of six people, three men, three women. One of them was the minister, one of them was a minister's wife, One of them was an elder or deacon. One of them was an elder or deacon's wife. And then two of them were 18 to 34 year olds, millennials. Most of the time it was two seniors, two high school seniors. And the moderator would be one of the ministers. And this panel of intergenerational panel of six people would answer five questions that the seniors would gather together out of all the questions posted by the congregation on a wall that we had in the auditorium. And they would gather all the questions, they would sift them, they would prioritize them, and they would pick five that they wanted to have answered so that it was a relevant conversation to them. And they, each member would pick two questions that they would answer, a four-minute answer apiece, and this conversation would stay between the panelists, and it wouldn't there wouldn't be any back-and-forth Q&A in the audience. And how it went in terms of the six events that we've had thus far, we're going to have our last one next Wednesday. We're going to, in total, talk about 40 questions. 40 questions in seven events, and we've had 27 different panelists participate. And we've talked about a lot of different topics, some of them being homosexuality, the validity of the Bible, politics, the legalization of marijuana, masturbation, environmental care, gender roles, suicide, so on and so forth. All the things we don't usually talk about when we're all together in the same space in the auditorium. We did on the first Wednesday night of each month this past year. It's been really great. And I want to share with you just three of the top stories that we pulled from this experience together over this past year. And one of those stories has to do with one of our senior students. And I think that this is the biggest win because this allowed her to stay plugged into church, whereas before she didn't feel really plugged in or engaged at all in church life. And this is a girl who has been wrestling with sexual identity and sexual preference, and through this process has felt comfortable enough to come out to my wife. And it's enabled her to stay plugged into something she is passionate about inside the church walls, and have conversations that she was going to already have outside the church walls and have them inside the church in that safe environment with other people of God. And she has remained engaged and eager to participate throughout the whole process and develop leadership within there as a result, which was one of the goals as well. And so that was probably our biggest win in terms of what we hoped that it would do for our seniors. And this is just one picture of what it did do for our seniors, thankfully. Another cool story is an elder. His name's Gary, and he participated in one of the panels, and he said this at the end of one of the evenings. He basically said, "Hey, I changed my mind about something that we talked about tonight and off the wall." It's like you don't always hear that an elder changes his mind. You know, you don't hear that too often. And I asked him about it further, and it was based off a question that somebody posted about that was upset about us loading up the candy that we were going to use in Trunk or Treat for that Halloween on the stage to show the congregation how much we had and how much we needed to go. And somebody was upset about that. And so, like, the question was, you know, is the church building holy or is it not? I mean, how should we understand that? And I emailed him about it, and he said, I adjusted my viewpoint on this. He says, normally I would just say, no, the church building's not holy. That's dumb. Of course we can put candy on the stage. And then in terms of how it adjusted, he says, I went from no, the church building is not holy, to no, the church building is dedicated, which is a different kind of holy. And we're dedicated to God for his service. And trunk or treat brings honor and glory to God. And candy on stage brings honor and glory to God by the people that we meet and interact with and plug into in trunk or treat. So yes, of course, because the church building is holy and dedicated to God, candy on the stage is good. I thought it was cool. And the third story involves David Bougainville. He's just a regular member in his 60s. And he was kind of a surprise out of left field, because he was someone whose involvement fluctuates. He tends to be one of the quieter individuals in church life there at Davis Park. But he walked up to me immediately following one of the events. And he said, you know, I got to be on the next one. I love what we're doing here, so please, can I be part of this panel next month? And I'm like, sure. I wasn't going to tell him no. This was one of the things we were hoping would happen through this. And so he was so gung-ho about participating, you know, albeit he's not the most technologically advanced man in the world, he doesn't even have a cell phone, that, you know, he came to our front door one day to make sure he had the right questions that he was going to answer in the panel and that he was headed in the right direction with his answers. Came to all the way to our house one day to make sure about that. And I just thought, that's really cool. This is just awesome. This is another thing that we're wanting to happen through this. And so those are just three simple stories that have bred out of us creating a space to express doubts and questions within the life of Davis Park in order to help develop a faith that sticks within all members of our congregation, not just high school students. And so, to kind of end this talk, end it this way. The musical score in the movie Interstellar was one, if not the best musical original music scores of the year. It didn't win an Oscar, but many people thought that it should have, and I believe it was Hans Zimmer that was behind the score. And the main instrument used in the composition of that score was an organ in a church in London, London's Temple Church. Used in a movie that didn't even talk or mention God. And they chose it for several reasons. One of the reasons was because of its significance to science, because it was one of the most technologically advanced creations, machines of its time when it was created back in the day. But also because it just really looked like a spaceship, and it was really cool, as you can kind of tell with this picture. That's why they used the organ. But one of our goals, if we're going to nurture an authentic faith within the people and disciples and Christians of our congregations, is to do what a movie that does not mention God, it's to do what a movie does that does not mention God inside our churches that don't often mention doubts. I'm going to say that again because I kind of messed it up. One of our goals, if we are to nurture an authentic faith within the Christians within our faith communities, is to do what a movie does that does not mention God inside our churches that don't often mention doubts. And that is to create a safe space and culture where doubts can be expressed. And ultimately that goal hopefully will come to creating disciples whose faith progresses to such a degree that they will go further with it as a result, to the kind of point that James, the brother of Jesus, went in his life when he gave it on behalf of God that day in Jerusalem in the 60s. So, I'm done. We've got a few minutes left. If there's any questions, let me have it, and I'll see if I can give a good answer. All right. Well, thank you guys for coming here tonight or this afternoon, and have a good rest of the day.